Welcome to the Conservative Podcast. I'm your host, Big Skinny. Tonight, we're going to visit with a man who is clinical full professor of management at Drexel University Laval's College of Business. He has also studied at Moscow State University and the Institut de Gestion Sociale in Paris. He is a former military intelligence officer who served in West Berlin near the Czech-German border, where he received the George S. Patton Award for Leadership from the 7th Army NCO Academy. In addition to his teaching, he also lectures widely in the United States and internationally. He is Drexel's faculty sponsor for Turning Point USA, serves on Drexel's Faculty Senate, and on Drexel's University Institutional Review Board. He is a frequent contributor to national media, including Newsmax and American Greatness, and is also highly praised faculty instructor for the course Strategic Thinking in the DVD series, TheGreatCourse.com. He lives and works in the Philadelphia metro area. He is also the author of Brutal Minds. We will be sitting down to talk to Dr. Stanley K. Ridgely tonight, and he will tell us in great detail how our colleges and universities are under attack by ideologues who spread their Marxist ideology in various methods to unsuspecting and sometimes receptive college students, and how we fight back. And it's all on this episode of the Conservative Podcast. Stick around.
Kenny, great to be here.
So Stanley has written a book, and I tell you what, it's a really compelling book. It is a really great book. It's got a lot of great information in it. It's called Brutal Minds, and it is all about how our institutions of higher learning have just about hijacked our system, and they're pumping in their own doctrine, talking about brainwashing going on. And there's it comes in forms of many different names. And when they find out one name, they change it and move it to something else. Can you expand on this a little bit for us, Stanley?
Well, Kenny, let me just preface by saying that Brutal Minds is a book about the decline of higher education, because I think most of us have a kind of a visceral understanding that our higher education institutions are just not up to snuff. They're not doing the job that we expect of them. And we see that they are definitely in decline. They're always in the news these days, and not in a good way. Well, Brutal Minds focuses on why we have this decline, who's responsible for it, what we can do about it. But most important, I think, it focuses on how there's a claque of individuals on almost every college campus that is indeed engaged in brainwashing or thought reform of our college students. And this, I think, is one of the most serious defects of our higher education system today, in that this is tomorrow's generation. And we have allowed this cancer to metastasize on our college campuses to a greater or lesser extent, depending on which college or university you're talking about, that we've allowed it to metastasize, and we've not done anything about it. We have allowed ourselves to wallow in ignorance and blame, you know, left-wing faculty, the nutty professor, the aging activist, when there is an entire bureaucracy engaged in basically attacking our young people in a quasi-legal manner and practicing a psychological manipulation, behavior modification activities to target our youth and to change their belief system.
Something you brought up too in your book is, you know, that kind of psychotherapy is really against the law unless they sign some kind of consent form saying it's okay to do so, right?
Yes, it is. It's definitely against the law. I'm a member. I serve on the Institutional Review Board at my university. This is the body of faculty and staff who evaluate these types of programs. And so I'm versed in what is legal and what is, you know, treads the line, and then what is illegal. And many of these activities do require informed consent for the target or the victim. But I will tell you this, that many students don't even know that they're being run through a program like this. It's not like they announce it. Hey, come on over, we're going to brainwash you. No, they don't do that. It's an orientation. It's a difficult dialogue. It's a courageous conversation. And when a student with his or her peers show up, they are run through a three-stage brainwash session that is pretty standard operation, and I can describe that as we get deeper into your show. Yeah, so it is illegal, in a lot of places.
And your background in intelligence, you have a background in intelligence, so you would know what it's like, or what, you know, what it's all about for someone to be brainwashed by, say, a cult, or say some kind of political leanings, or, you know, even, you know, it's just, it's crazy. But you have, you would have the knowledge about that, right?
I like to think so. Yes, that's my area of expertise. I left the military intelligence, and I went to graduate school, and my focus was on Soviet ideology and international relations at the time, because the Soviet Union, of course, was a communist country, and along with communist China and North Korea, practiced this type of ideological coercion on its own populace. Now, we have those pesky individual rights here in the United States. And so universities have to be, democracies, I should say, have to be a little more careful with how they operate the system. The only two organizations in the United States that utilize the brainwash regularly and to a great extent are, on the one hand, cults, referring to the Moonies and Synanon and People's Temple, things like that.
And the Kool-Aid.
Say again?
Drink the Kool-Aid?
Yes, basically that. I researched on that. That part of that appears in my book. It was really Flavor-Aid. I want to, you know, clear that up. And when people use the term drink the Kool-Aid, it was really Flavor-Aid that the socialist Jim Jones forced his followers to drink at gunpoint. Nothing so dramatic as that going on the college campuses, and I like to think in cults on American soil. But there is a program that is easily identifiable, that is three stages long, and that the bureaucrats who staff the bureaucracy in student affairs, who run what is called the co-curriculum, they know how to do this. They're trained how to do this. I've got several brainwash manuals here with me that I can share with you in a few moments that actually describe this process. And I describe this in Brutal Minds, and I cite these folks. In fact, Brutal Minds, as you know, is about 70% written in their words. So it's not what I'm saying that they're doing. It's what they themselves say that they're doing. And it's horrific.
What are the you give a couple of names from different countries of brainwashing techniques. Can you give me those here?
Yeah, well, the main one is Communist China. Communist China, the word for brainwash is Sei Nao, which means wash brain. And that was kind of created or coined by Edward Hunter back in the 1950s. And it was discovered, and there are two scholars, Robert J. Lifton and Edgar Schein, that discovered that this brainwashing program, whereby the populace would be re-educated, this came out of the United States by an MIT social psychologist by the name of Kurt Lewin in the 1940s. If you're ever wondering where the term re-education came from, who coined it, this is the guy who did. It was Dr. Kurt Lewin. And he coined it as he developed a program of encounter groups. He's known as the father of encounter groups, whereby criminals would be run through this brainwashing program, this re-education program, so that they would not slide back into their, you know, into the life of crime. He was trying to counter the recidivism. He was also engaged in trying to reduce people's prejudice, racial prejudice, at the time in the 1940s. Well, the Communist Chinese basically set up their program of re-education, which they called re-education, in a similar fashion. And it's a three-stage process. Mao Zedong was kind of unique in this aspect. Instead of shooting his political enemies like Stalin and Lenin did, and he decided, hey, maybe we can turn them and re-educate them, put them through a rigorous brainwashing program to change their attitude. And he called these rectification campaigns or re-education campaigns. And there were several of them into the 50s. The most, I think, well-known of these would be the Great Cultural Revolution, where several rectification campaigns were run in conjunction with the Cultural Revolution from 1966 to 1976. It was a horrible time in communist China, and an estimated 2 million people died of torture and starvation, and basically the rigors of going through a program like this. North Korea is another country that is engaged in this, in a very rigorous program of re-education, borrowing it, of course, from the Communist Chinese. Now, the Communist Chinese still do this, and they do it with primarily with a minority group called the Uyghurs, the Muslim minority group that they are persecuting regularly, even now, even as we speak, running them through this re-education camp, re-education process. Interestingly, the folks in the United States that really are adepts or acolytes of Kurt Lewin's re-education program, in the 1990s, they discovered that re-education was automatically coupled with re-education camp, and it had an unsavory connotation. And so they decided to stop using the term re-education, and they changed it to transformative education. And they use this quite freely on the college campuses. So when you hear the term, we're going to offer up some transformative education for the student body, they're really saying we're offering up Kurt Lewin's re-education. What's interesting as well is the communist Chinese, they're not dumb, and they realize that public relations are important. They changed the name of their program as well from re-education to Education for Transformation. Very similar to what our folks in academia are doing today.
So there's three ways, or there's three things that they have to do to make this stick. There's three steps in order to make this brainwashing stick. Let's go over the first one. They have to unfreeze.
Right. Well, this is Kurt Lewin's model. It's been changed. The terminology has been changed, but it's the same program. I can show you a manual right here. It's called Teaching for Diversity and Social Justice. This is the first edition, came out in 1997, and it covers the three steps that you're talking about. This is the same book in 2023, came out in 2023. It's come out in four editions, and the basic process is let me fix this real quick for us real quick.
Okay.
The basic process is the same, but what has happened is they've changed the terminology. Kurt Lewin began with unfreezing the belief system, changing the belief system, and then refreezing the belief system so that there's no backsliding. And the whole purpose of this is to change the belief system of someone. And the folks on the college campuses in student affairs who run difficult dialogues, courageous conversations, and generally speaking, what they call social justice education, utilizes this three-stage process. Now, you mentioned the first stage. That first stage is absolutely critical, crucial for the brainwash to work. And it involves gaining the trust of the students. Now, you know as well as I do, no one's going to say, hey, we got a new orientation session, and we're going to call it the brainwash session, and we're going to change your belief system to something that, you know, is better than what your parents gave you. No, they're not going to say that. Of course not. Instead, they're going to invite students, the people with big smiles on their faces, and they're offering free drinks, free pizza, and maybe some cornhole competitions and everything. We're going to come on in. We're going to have an orientation. And the whole point of this is to gain the students' trust. They absolutely are desperate to gain the students' trust. And this is clearly spelled out in their manuals, the ones that I just held up to you. Here's another one. This one's called Promoting Diversity and Social Justice, Educating People from Privileged Groups. And in this, it follows the same three-step process. That first stage is gaining trust. And they'll do this through techniques like this. They instruct their facilitators to model vulnerability, model it, engage in some self-disclosure, disclose some sort of meaningless tidbit from your life to try to get students to divulge something or self-disclose something from their own life. Model vulnerability, help the student feel free to make himself or herself feel vulnerable, you know, express yourself. And all the while, they're collecting information that they can use against the student in the second stage. That information includes information about family and friends and parents, income, lifestyle, political beliefs, social, cultural beliefs, collecting an inventory of these things, whereby they can take and then use that to attack the student in the second stage and destabilize the student's belief system. This is something that they are clear about. They say this to themselves. They say this to each other in their various books. Here's another one right here. Designing transformative multicultural initiatives by Sherry K. Watt. This lout, Sherry K. Watt, is one of the worst of the people who brainwash students. Her actual declaration is, I want to destabilize the student's belief system, to create intellectual vertigo, to create a situation where the student feels uncertain about his or her reality, questions his or her belief system that was given to him or crafted in the way they were brought up, so that it makes the student more malleable so that they can then install a new belief system. And this is a part of the whole nastiness of this is, what does that belief system consist of? And I can talk about that here in a few minutes.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Okay, so depending on your race, they're gonna approach you from different directions. They're going to come at you two different ways, right?
Yes, it's a very primitive Manichaean or binary worldview that they offer. It's a world of oppressors and oppressed, exploiters and exploited.
Well, let's go into that a little bit. So let's say you're a young white student and they're coming at you. What are they going to attack?
Well, they're going to attack you and try to explain to you, after they've made you comfortable and investing all of this trust, they're going to show you in a gradual manner these inconsistencies or contradictions in your society. They're going to start talking about oppression and who is oppressed and who is not, who is privileged and who is not. And they're going to instill a sense of guilt and personal responsibility for this. Whether you have anything to do with it or not, they want to show you that your silence, your mere existence, is complicity in a system of oppression. This is where they begin to introduce this whole notion of systematic racism, systemic racism and oppression. And if you happen to be a person of color, as they say, a black student or a brown student or a Latino or a Chinese or Asian of other extraction, they want to convince that you are a victim of this system of oppression, whether you feel victimized or not. And so this is the end result of coming out of the, the brainwash, to make people guilty of who they are by virtue of their skin color. And that is the replacement system of belief. It's called, and this is the term they use, critical consciousness. Critical consciousness. The Brazilian term is a consciência social. And they're very proud of that this comes out of a third world educationist by the name of Paulo Freire, who supposedly coined this consciência social, or critical consciousness. And it's the idea that when you gain critical consciousness, you can now see into the contradictions of society. You can see the relationships of power and privilege. And this is a kind of a vision that is denied to you, Kenny. It's denied to me, Dr. Ridgely, because I simply am, we are imbued with false consciousness. What's false consciousness? It's kind of a tautology or circular reasoning. False consciousness means we haven't yet ascended to critical consciousness. And so this is the anointed state whereby when you achieve critical consciousness, you finally understand the realities of our society. And this is why students, when they go home for that first Thanksgiving break, they're so angry at their parents, because they are taught to reject everything that their parents have stand for, have worked for, the love and the work, the investment in their student's future. The student then rejects all of that because it's all part of a system of oppression that the student is now aware of by virtue of critical consciousness.
So what is the end game in this? I know the end game in this step is to get the subject to, come out and apologize and make a statement saying that, something of remorse, saying they're sorry for what they've done and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But beyond that, what is the end result they're desiring for this brainwashing?
Well, I think the end result is captured in the motto of one of the off-campus student affairs bureaucrat clubs or guilds or professional organizations. Their motto is this: boldly transforming higher education. That's what these student affairs non-faculty have in mind: boldly transforming higher education. And I like to add to it to make it the campus safe for Marx and Mao. That's what they're about. Their ideology comes directly from Marx by way of the Frankfurt School critical theorists, and they call it critical theory and critical pedagogy so that they don't have to use the M word, Karl Marx, or Mao for that matter. And they have basically laundered this Marxist theory through a Brazilian educator that I mentioned. His name is Paulo Freire. No one's going to get exercised about Paulo Freire because they don't know who he is. He was a Marxist, became a Marxist in the 60s, became a Maoist in the 70s. And his education theory, cribbed from Mao Zedong, it stands as the gospel of education schools in the United States. So what's the end game? Well, they being the critical theorists, the educationists, the student affairs folks, want to transform the university from what it is today and has traditionally been since the scientific revolution and the Enlightenment, that being the university as a repository, a crucible, repository of knowledge, of hard-won knowledge over the last 300 years, an institution that has successfully expunged superstition and magical thinking and pseudoscience such as alchemy and astrology and the search for the philosopher's stone and pseudoscience, expunged all of that, and now have a body of hard-won knowledge that we want to transmit to subsequent generations who then will contribute their hard-won knowledge. The leftists, the brainwashers, don't want that. They don't like that. That's not consonant with what their goals and what they have in mind. What they want is the university to become a crucible of Marxist indoctrination. I had a Marxist theorist by the name of Fred Jameson said this to me many years ago at Duke University. He's a very famous theoretician amongst the cognoscenti, those who know. He said it in a meeting that I was attending. He said that the purpose of higher education, the purpose of university, is to train students for the Marxist struggles of the future. Now, this was a very influential theorist, Frederick Jameson. You can look him up. He is one of the folks who is engineering this sort of, and he's still alive, engineering this sort of transformation of the university. And what we have is this people in this bureaucracy who are not faculty. They're clerks, enrollment managers, academic advisors, dorm room managers, or I should say res life managers. They have upsold themselves in their own minds, and they hope that you and I buy into it. They've upsold themselves as higher education professionals, as college educators, and they believe, and they really believe this, it is their job to educate students just like faculty do, and they want to educate students holistically, and they want to message students 24/7. I have students 4 hours a week in my classes. They have students 24/7 in dorm rooms and in the dining halls and in various counseling sessions, and they run a program on the campus called the co-curriculum. It's a fake curriculum. They want to be just like faculty. So faculty teach in a curriculum. They're going to create a co-curriculum. It's going to have fake professors or fake instructors. It'll have fake courses. It'll even have a fake transcript. And universities such as Rutgers, St. John's, Westchester University recognize and offer this fake transcript for this out-of-classroom experience. And it is here in this out-of-classroom experience that they message students 24/7 on this critical consciousness that they should be engaged in social justice activities, which I think I've left out the third stage of the brainwash. And that third stage is linked to what I just said. You may have heard the term, do the work. This is one of their tropes. This is one of their cliches that I robustly make fun of whenever I can. They're going to do the work. Well, this is really what they're training students to do. To prevent students from backsliding, you know, into their old belief system that they grew up with, they want to engage and occupy students as much as possible in activities designed to reinforce this new belief system, to reinforce their belief in doing work for social justice. They actually say this. They always talk about social justice, and this consists of pretty much anything they want to do that furthers the the ideology. They'll call it social justice, and they want to get students involved in as many of these projects, as much of these activities as they possibly can, so that they can cement the new belief system to keep them occupied, to get them to do the work of social justice.
So if we break this, we break those three steps down, Stanley, we look at them, you know, as a whole. Some people would argue, not me, but some people would argue, isn't this the same tactic that most church uses?
I can agree with you that right now. The only problem for the people who might say that are the fact that churches are perfectly upfront with what they do. You know exactly what you're going to get when you go to church. You know exactly what you're going to get when you say go to a religious college. Okay, you sign up for this. Okay, we do this, we do this, we do this, and here's how we do it. There's no deception. There's no deceit involved. What you see is what you get. What we're getting on the mainstream college campuses today, however, is deception for the very reasons I pointed out. They cannot afford to say, we want you to come in here and we're going to teach you in a workshop that is grounded in critical race theory, in which you are a villain and you can see the villains and victims simply by virtue of the color of your skin as you walk down the street.
Yeah, you're going to denounce your whole life right here in this classroom.
Exactly. So this kind of false argument or that you hear about, oh, well, don't these other, no, that they're upfront about what they do and they're very clear about that.
Yeah, that's good. So that was one of the questions I was, you know, when I saw this, I thought, that churches, you know, use that same method, but it's totally different because you're right. Because if you go to church, you know exactly what's going to happen.
Yes. And you're not paying to go to church except for what you offer in the offering. Right. You walk out if you don't like what's being served up. And the fact is, someone said that to me in an airport, they were arguing with me or talking with me, and they said, well, this is what the military does to young recruits. I said, and you know exactly what you're going to get when you go into the military. You're told, it's up front. There are books have been written about what the process is to train a young person to become a soldier. This is no secret. And this is what happens. This is what you sign up for. It's completely different in colleges and universities by virtue of this bureaucracy that by all accounts is simply self-appointed.
And then you look at the credentials of these people teaching this stuff, which really they don't have credentials. I mean, they have these fake credentials of maybe college degrees from some, you know, it's of some non-existent course or something that's of no use in general life.
Well, they have a degree in bureaucracy. I have to say that I heard this I was giving an interview with another podcast host and this, he said, weren't these just degrees in bureaucracy? And I have to agree, they're degrees in bureaucracy.
Yes.
They're higher education degrees. All of them are offered, by education schools. And education schools have been suffered, you know, with this inferiority complex for many decades. And they finally found a solution. And the solution was to create new degrees, advanced degrees, they call them. They call these degrees a master's in higher education management or an EDD in student affairs, right? Or educational leadership. Now, that sounds really sexy, you know, educational leadership. Well, the fact of the matter is, how do they define leadership? You look that up, and I have, because that's my task. They define leadership as basically social activism. That's how they define leadership. They want to train you to make you a social activist or a scholar practitioner, as they like to say, so that you can then become active in the social justice causes of the day. If I can go back to the second stage for a moment, because there's something I want to mention that absolutely necessary, that when we talk about deception and deceit, that I've mentioned, this is what they are engaged in. I'll give you an example of that. And I'll mention, I have no problem naming these people's names. I wish their names were on everyone's lips as the rogues and rascals that they are. This one is Professor Lisa Spanierman, who is a dean in the psychology department at Arizona State University. One of her articles she published just in the fall, about 6 months ago, was on guilt. And her being a psychologist, she is privy to a lot of the psychological techniques that work on people. And I think it's borders malpractice for what she said to do, for these social justice educators to do. She said this, it is possible to make a person feel guilty artificially about something they've had nothing to do with. She says, we have techniques that can make that happen. In other words, you know, Kenny goes into a classroom and within an hour you feel guilty about some historical event that you had absolutely nothing to do with. And she found that this made Kenny, or the person who was targeted, more susceptible and willing to work for social justice, to do the work of social justice in various realms. This is turpitude. It's deceit. It's deception, and it borders on malpractice. I'm going to have you come into my classroom, and she's basically talking, she's explicit about this, about her white students, perhaps mainly male white students, make them feel guilty artificially by utilizing psychological manipulation techniques that are well known. And once they begin to feel this guilt, recruit them to do work in social justice activities. That's the brainwash in a nutshell right there.
So talk about how this could be detrimental to some of these college students.
Oh, well, number one, I could give a lay person's explanation. It screws them up, or it makes them unsuited for life in an information society. It makes them unsuited to deal with people that they're going to run into, people that they have to get along with. It also alienates them from their parents. Generally speaking, it does. And that can be very severe. It can be a very long period of time before peace is made, and it's artificially done. And these people, and I call them scalawags and rogues and rascals, because that's what they are. They have no business or charge or mandate to alienate these kids from their parents. These are not faculty. They're not paid to do this sort of thing. Psychological casualties is what they're called. Many articles have been written on the psychological casualties of those who have been brainwashed. Primarily, we're talking about prisoners of war and intellectuals in a society like communist China's, where the intellectual class is targeted for retraining. But also in the United States, we see the results in cults of what happens when people are brainwashed. They can't speak in other than cliches and slogans and mantras. And we see a lot of this with college students who are protesting in the streets right now. They really can't think for themselves. They can't mount an argument. They have been given privy to the truth. They don't need to mount an argument. And that's the way they think. They have been ushered into the realm of those in the company of those who know. And their parents, of course, don't know. You, Kenny, don't know. I don't know. They have advanced to critical consciousness. And this is the deleterious impact. Once you begin to think this way, there's no reason for you to think any other way. There's no reason for you to entertain other ideas or to learn how to argue your point. You simply dismiss the other side as being imbued with false consciousness, or you simply don't know. You simply are have an inability to grasp these high-level arguments that we have here, those of us who have critical consciousness. So this can be a long-term effect and have a long-term, short-term impact. But the bad thing is a lot of these people graduate having been duped, I like to say. They can't think critically. They can't argue. They can't make a case for anything. And then they get hired into positions by people just like them. And they begin to act on these bizarre beliefs. I think an example of this would be Catherine Meyer, who just was appointed as the CEO of NPR, National Public Radio. If you look at some of her tweets from prior years and listen to some of her speeches, it's clear that this is a woman who is completely imbued with this narcissistic view, this narcissistic, grandiose self-conception of I have privy to the truth. I have privy to these secrets and these internal contradictions within society. I have this critical consciousness. She's almost a parody of what one of these people is like. If you're ever looking for something, go see Catherine Meyer, the new CEO of NPR. Look up her TED Talks and you'll see someone who is afflicted with thought reform.
So, you know, I see a lot of this too on social media. You talk about people that can't make an argument for their point of view. Right. You see on social media where someone will post a meme or something with some kind of saying from somebody. You know, they can't think for themselves. They've got to put somebody else's thoughts down.
Right.
I think if you believe a certain way, you ought to be able to explain in detail why you believe the way you believe. Right.
well, yes, I have nothing but respect for a committed Marxist who can sit down and go down the line as to why this person is a committed Marxist, looking at the economics, the politics, the philosophical roots of this. I mean, I'm the first person to tell you that Karl Marx was a brilliant guy. Now, he was wrong on a whole host of things, and he basically thought, him being a narcissist as well, that he had unlocked the secrets of history the same way that Charles Darwin had unlocked the secrets of evolution. And this is why he being Karl Marx, believed in scientific socialism, the idea of analyzing and understanding it, finally understanding it all. And Marx believed he had created a comprehensive cosmology that answered all questions. Well, anyone knows that a comprehensive cosmology, any one of those, is a pseudoscience, basically. Any construct that claims to be able to answer all questions but can't make any predictions about the future is pseudoscience. It's pseudoscientific. Karl Popper, the philosopher of science, was a great one of my favorite people of all time, was very clear on this in his works. He's one of the clearest writers on this as well. He's not some high-level Karl Marxian type of opaque prose. And so these folks are imbued with this idea that they have access to the truth. Committed Marxists as well. I'll stand toe to toe with most any Marxist who is knowledgeable, but most folks are not knowledgeable who mouth this. Most of the folks who talk about these issues that we've been discussing today don't even know that Karl Marx is the originator of many of their ideas, and that many of their ideas, such as critical theory or critical pedagogy, critical race theory, they are completely unaware that those are euphemisms for Marxism. The critical theorists of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s said, and this is true, they said that we've got to come up with something, some sort of vernacular that hides the Marxist origin of our belief system. This is at a time when if you were Marxist, you were not going to get a hearing to do anything. So they came up with a vernacular where they could hide their Marxism. And their words they came up with was critical theory. Now, this is you know, well known for those who look at critical theory and understand this. And they came up with a vernacular that sounded esoteric and magical. And it was almost like a priesthood. And it was very attractive to graduate students in philosophy. They had the idea that, wow, I'm being ushered in to the company of those who know. And they talk about interrogating. They talk about unpacking. They talk about transgressing boundaries. They talk about centering the marginalized, and talking all of this sort of thing that sounds kind of odd to the person on the street, and with good reason. It's a made up vernacular. It was completely made up to hide the Marxist core within. And so that is the nutshell.
Is it kind of like when you hear presidents speak about the bottom up and the top down kind of deal? I mean, it doesn't make any sense. I'm trying to listen to his definition of the economy, how he wants to shape the economy, bottom out, up, down, top. It sounds like a Diana Ross song.
Well, I've not heard that, but I will tell you this. I look askance and I look with suspicion, raised eyebrow at anyone who talks about how he's going to shape the economy, because this has shades of the Soviet command economy. The idea of the economy is something that we can tune up just like an automobile. I think that Justin Trudeau revealed his true colors when he said in a very infamous YouTube speech he was giving, he was sitting and talking to young people and he was admiring the communist Chinese. And he said, "Oh, the Chinese, they can turn their economy on a dime." I'm quoting Justin Trudeau. "They can turn their economy on a dime," as if this is a good thing, not recognizing or acknowledging an economy is made up of hundreds upon hundreds, millions of people whose lives are affected when you begin to issue these top-down edicts to achieve short-term political goals. And so that's what I began to think of when you mentioned this top-down edict by our current president. The idea, whenever presidents start talking about how they're going to juice the economy or fine-tune the economy or going to prime the pump, that sort of thing, bad things are going to happen. And they're usually listed under the category of unintended consequences.
So this philosophy, this Marxism, as we're going to call it, because that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Where do you think, I mean, surely it's not these educators coming up with this. There's got to be a bigger power behind it, a bigger power at play behind trying to shape the world and this, that, and the other. Do you have an idea who do you think might be behind this? I mean, we can't just say it's the educators trying to change the colleges.
Well, I could speculate on a whole host of things, and I'd like to stay away from speculation because I like to stick to issues that are within my, as they say, my wheelhouse that I can really pull up at a moment's notice, justification, substantial, you know, three examples of evidence. I'm not going to get into, you know, who might be behind this sort of thing, but I do think that Marxism has a staying power that is absolutely phenomenal, regardless and irrespective of the millions of people that were killed in the last century under the banner of Marxism, whether it was people killed by Lenin, by Stalin, by Mao, by Pol Pot in Cambodia, by the North Koreans, that it's almost as if I will tell you this, the left has a funny way of thinking about this. They think of themselves in such a precious light, so narcissistic are they, that every time socialism suffers a blow, loses a battle and is taken over by the market or by cap, and they go into a kind of a funk, and they call this left melancholy. They actually have a name for it, left melancholy. And it was crafted by Walter Benjamin in the 1920s, the last century, and taken up by, it came out of Sigmund Freud as well. And people like Wendy Brown and Judith Butler, who are scholars on the West Coast, they like to talk about left melancholy. And this is their belief in a better world. And they feel betrayed every time socialism fails. And they don't really discuss the millions of people, hundreds of thousands or millions of people who are killed. As Stalin said, you know, to build socialism, it's like making an omelet. You have to break a few eggs. That's how he viewed the deaths of millions of people for which he was responsible. And so I think I can't explain what the attraction is of this, except there's this narcissistic view that if socialism fails, that means I have failed. And therefore, I'm not going to allow socialism to fail in my own mind. I'm going to keep the faith. And there are a lot of people like this. There are a lot of self-professed Marxists on my campus. I've dealt with them. I've conversed with them. And they're not unlikable people. But I'm talking about faculty. I'm not talking about these foot soldier types who are mounting the barricades, have no clue that they're doing it for Karl Marx, doing it for critical theory. And they have no idea who they're doing it for. I think that is great. It's great to speculate on these types of things, but I'll leave that to you, Kenny.
All right, let me ask you one more question.
Sure.
Is you think this green initiative and all that's tied to it?
I don't know if it's tied to it. I do know it's absurd. I think it's absurd for a number of reasons. And I really, when I deal with students sometimes who actually come up with a project in my business classes that is going to electric powered, you know, automobile, that'd be the obvious example. I said, well, have you thought about the supply chain? Have you thought about where that electricity is going to come from? Have you simply moved the burning of the fossil fuels outside of your purview? It's in a coal-fired plant somewhere that's generating electricity that's going to come through some wires that you're going to charge up your electric vehicle. When we begin talking about the lithium mines, the cobalt mines, we talk about the inadequacy of wind turbines. We talk about the inadequacy of solar panels. We talk about our grid now that cannot handle the capacity that we have now, handling even more capacity. We talk about the sacrifice of national security to the net communist Chinese, who are more than great, you know, happy to build new coal plants and while they make solar panels and wind turbines and sell them to us. They're happy to do that. They're happy to have us go green. I do think that there's an anti-American national security element to it, and that people who believe this climate change issue as their number one issue really need to look more deeply into it to find out, you know, what it's all about. I would say that any conversation about climate change that does not include China, India, Malaysia, Indonesia, the greatest polluters in the world, that's a conversation I'm not going to be a part of. not unless we begin to talk about the real polluters in the world. I will put it to you this way. There are people who say, well, China has to catch up. India has to catch up. And they can, you know, they're going to do this by burning fossil fuels and mining fossil fuels. And I say this, is this an existential crisis or not? Is it an existential crisis or not? You're telling me it's an existential crisis, but the Chinese and the Indians need to catch up. I said, well, no, it's either an existential crisis and everyone has to tighten their belt, or it's not an existential crisis and we're all just making believe. Yeah. So that's how I view the whole situation on that.
All right. So heading back to the brutal minds, we're going to wrap this up, but let's tell parents how they can recognize some of these characteristical traits that these students might show if they've, you know, been brainwashed, or they start noticing their child acting differently.
Well, Brutal Minds actually has a whole list of things to look at. My book is really cautionary and predictive in the sense that you read the book and then you know what to look for. If your student has already gone through a brainwash and comes home, you know, dressing differently, angry about seemingly innocuous things, and basically contemptuous of his or her parents. That's one of the worst things that can happen. Contemptuous at one's parents, either at their education, at the way they dress, the way they talk, the things that they consider important. That is one of the results of the brainwash. If you see a contempt in your student, your parent, your kid, that wasn't there before, they have been subjected to the brainwash and the idea of critical consciousness. They believe that they have been ushered into the realm in the privileged company of those who know. They have ascended to critical consciousness. And I would tell parents to say, mention that to your kids. Ask them, oh, you have critical consciousness now, which means that your mom and I have false consciousness. Is that what you're trying to say? Is that what's going on here? But I would say read Brutal Minds, become conversant in the types of things that they'll be exposed to. If a high school senior gets hold of this book, reads this book before going, they will be absolutely amazed at what they'll see, that it's going to play out exactly as my book shows. And that's why the left hates this book. It exposes everything they do. And it's something that I think that is essential to every college student. I will tell you this. I had one parent, and this is an unfortunate symptom. Parents tell me, well, my son is well-grounded morally, politically, philosophically, brought up well, no danger here. And they're going to go off to something like San Diego State. And I say, well, this is what they can expect. No problem here. I said, well, the problem is this. Parents think that their kids who are well-grounded morally, philosophically, politically, culturally, socially, are going to go off to a place, the college, where all just different ideas are going to be discussed, and we're going to have it's going to be a yeasty intellectual experience, just like it was when I was in school. That's what they think. And that's not what's going to happen. The danger is their kids are going to be targeted, especially the ones who are brought up the way that I've described, especially the ones who are targeted by virtue of their skin color. They are going to be singled out, and they're going to go through a program that is designed to strip away that belief system and replace it with something else. See, that's the big problem or trick that parents need to be aware of. It is not a benign enjoying of the fruits of higher education. No, there's an attack, and it's going to be launched at your kids.
So I think this would be a great book for parents to give to their children, if the seniors heading off to college this year. And if they'd like to get a hold of this book, where can you send them to find this book?
Well, I'd send them to Amazon.com. I know it's Jeff Bezos, but you know it's on sale right now. And I hate it when they put my book on sale, if you know what I mean. Yeah. But it's on sale right now. I can't do anything about that. It's a steal. And you can also go to Barnes & Noble, and you can order it there. It's still on the shelves in Barnes & Noble. Barnes & Noble has been very good about putting that book up front, when you walk in, when it's on sale. And you go to Brutal Minds, my website, and click on Brutal Minds, which will turn you right back around and send you to Amazon or several other places that offer
like a round trip.
Yes,
a round trip to Amazon.
I'm just trying to get you, you know, and build traffic for my site so you get interested.
Yes, sir. I appreciate the library of books you sent me. In fact, I would like for you to get me in touch with some of these authors of these books. I'd like to have them on our podcast if you have any contact with them.
I surely can. I'll be happy to do that for you.
You know, and it's funny you mentioned Barnes & Noble's, because that Barnes & Noble's has a special place in my heart. That's where me and my wife met for the first time.
Oh, so, well, congratulations on that. So, you know,
we are big Barnes & Noble's fan.
Well, that's good. So bookstores are great to go into, and especially used bookstores, I like to say.
Yes, sir. Well, brother, we appreciate you being on tonight. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the podcast. And we're going to keep throwing the word out there about this. People need to know about it.
Thanks so much. I do appreciate the opportunity. God bless.
All right, sir. Have a good one.
Thank you.